You're listening to the FinTech Thought Leaders podcast from QED Investors, your deep dive into the world of venture capital and financial services with today's digital disruptors. QED is a global venture capital firm focused on investing in fintech companies all the way from pre-seed to IPO. FinTech Thought Leaders brings together the most talented entrepreneurs tackling today's biggest problems. If you're looking to learn more about what motivates our founders and team members to succeed, you're in the right place. Hello, and welcome to the FinTech Thought Leaders podcast. I'm Bill Salufo, Head of Early Stage Investments at QED Investors. Today on the podcast, I'm excited to be joined by Hello Alice co-founders, CEO Carolyn Rods and President Elizabeth Gore. Ladies, welcome to the podcast.
Howdy. Thank you, Bill.
So this one's going to be really exciting, I think, for a couple different reasons. Not only is Hello Alice a really exciting story and look forward to having the listeners hear all about it, it's the first time we've ever had two guests on at the same time, so you guys will tax my interviewer skills. Hopefully I can rise to the occasion. But probably the most interesting conversation we're going to have is actually related to a lawsuit that Hello Alice is going through, which really kind of cuts at the core of many of the principles that Hello Alice and us at QED hold dear. So we'll probably cover that later on in the discussion, but just wanted to tease the listeners to listen to that. I think it'll be one of the most interesting conversations that we've had on this podcast to date. But to get us started, before we get into too much of the details, Carolyn, I wonder if you could just give maybe a little bit of a 60-second commercial on, you know, what Hello Alice is and what y'all do.
Sure. Hello Alice is a digital platform that connects over 1.3 million small business owners to the capital, connections, and opportunities that they need to build healthier businesses. We're taking into account their business and personal data profile and making sure they get the best resources at the right moment in time to push their companies forward, help them build healthy, strong, and sustainable businesses that benefit all of us.
That's awesome. Do you have an example of what, you know, one of the more kind of common services that you offer to help businesses?
Yeah, we focus very much on Main Street businesses, whether it's a restaurant in your local community or whether it's a accountant or service provider, but making sure that they, one, understand the fundamentals of their business. How are they building healthy financials? How are they making sure that they're building operational efficiencies into their company? We focus a lot on access to capital, and we've built a really early stage capital continuum, starting with our grants program. We've deployed nearly $40 million in grants. We have a credit card program, both a secured and unsecured card, that serves as a community tool, a credit enhancement tool, and a credit card all wrapped into one. We have a lending marketplace where we focus on really early stage loans from CDFIs or specialty funds that are targeting entrepreneurs when mainstream capital doesn't work for them, all with the goal of moving them into the financial tools that they can access at their local bank. But the reality is most small businesses aren't yet ready for those tools. And that's where Hello Alice steps in to make sure that they're getting those stepping stones along the way for the freedom of choice so they can walk into their bank and access a loan like many later stage companies are able to do.
Perfect. I mean, it's, I think, long been true that small businesses are some of the more underserved customers in not just America, but really around the world.
So we have a huge focus on the new majority of entrepreneurs. So women, people of color, veterans, people with disabilities, making sure that we're really focusing on those that have been traditionally underserved and providing a really diverse set of tools to a really diverse audience that's representative of what small business looks like today in America.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, I look forward to getting into more details on the company a little later on in the podcast. But we'd love to start a little bit by hearing a bit about your all's backgrounds, kind of what led you to the point we're at. So Elizabeth, I wonder if we can start with you. Just can you give a quick summary of kind of your story and what led up to where you are now?
Well, Bill, I am probably the least likely to be sitting here, having grown up in South Texas on a cattle ranch. I was the first woman in my family to go to college, and I studied cattle, not finance. So very circuitous route, but actually, college did. I went to Texas A&M and opened up my eyes to there's much more to the world than beyond a fence, I guess I could say. And actually had a full career as a humanitarian prior to going in the private sector. So worked for former President Bush 41 at his Point of Light Foundation and then joined the Peace Corps. Very proud to serve in the U.S. Peace Corps in South America. And then was with the UN for 10 years. And it was there that I really got focused and passionate about the power of the microeconomy. For me, it was in developing countries that, you know, anywhere where the UN was leaving, whether it was after a natural disaster or war, which is super relevant right now, if you didn't have small business up and running, you will end up with a failed state. And when I came home and really focused on the US, I realized it was just as important here. And so jumped into the private sector, had the great pleasure to work for Michael Dell as his entrepreneur residence. And then I met the most brilliant entrepreneur I ever met in my life, Carolyn Rods. And our story continued from there.
That's amazing. Okay, so I have to ask a follow-up on the cattle piece. You probably get follow-ups all the time. So I'm about 3/4 of the way through binge-watching Yellowstone. How realistic is this, or how fake is this? I need to know.
Oh my God. Well, I've watched the whole thing twice, if that gives you an idea. And this drives Carolyn nuts. But my passion at Yellowstone is twofold. One is the horsemanship. So I'm a world champion equestrian. I went to school on a rodeo scholarship. Most of those cowboys you see on there are actual PRCA, legit cowboys and cattlewomen. So, and then the second is how hard ranching is. It was very hard to make money in ranching, which my family knows firsthand. The drama side of it, you know, that's just up to you, Bill, whether you like it or not. But Beth and Rip, I hope will continue.
I will say my wife and I are commenting that every episode has about a 5-minute gratuitous cowboying scene that has nothing to do with the story, and never knew if that was real or fake, and it sounds like it's real. That's exciting to know.
It is real.
Fantastic. Well, we could explore that in depth on a different pod.
Well, I'll say one other thing. If you really want to see what an entrepreneur is, look up Tyler Sheridan, who produced all those. I mean, he's got 7 shows right now and went from nothing to... You talk about raising money, which we all do as entrepreneurs. He bought the Four Sixes Ranch when he had nothing. He had to go out and raise that capital. Look that story up. Every entrepreneur should read that story.
Wow. I would have never guessed that was real. So I'm going to have to, check that out. That's super cool.
A lot of it's filmed on his ranch. So it's a really cool story.
Nice, nice. So Carolyn, I'd love to hear a bit of your story. That's hard to compete with. But
trust me. Just wait.
So different. It's funny, you know, when the universe brings two people together, it's like there were so many opportunities for Elizabeth and us to cross paths. And it took us a while, but I think when we finally came together, I couldn't have picked a better co-founder. Definitely the yin to my yang. It's like every counter that I need for my personality, she definitely fills. My mother is Bolivian, my father American. I really split my life between Houston and La Paz, Bolivia. Growing up, I would say culturally, our family really was much more kind of lean towards my mother's side on the Bolivian side. A really strong sense of family. We spent a ton of time at my grandparents. They ran a cookie factory, the largest cookie factory in Bolivia. And so we spent a lot of summers there. I interned at that cookie factory. For me, it was kind of my first exposure to entrepreneurship in a really tangible way. My father was an entrepreneur as well. He ran a commercial insurance business. Through my father, I learned this incredible work ethic and just focus and persistence to build something from nothing. My dad grew up with no money at all, worked construction to put himself through college, but it was a brilliant, brilliant man. And my mother had this massive family business, and being able to see this established company that really gave back to the community and educated employees and put community investment programs in place was really interesting to me, to see what a company could become and how it could make an impact inside a community. And so for me, I think both of those stories together and both of those very contrasting worlds that I sort of jumped back and forth between, this middle-class life in Houston and then this very, I don't even know how to describe Bolivia, but for me, it's just my like home, you know, it's home. It's part of my roots for sure. Those together, I think, just taught me that business really is a path forward. And so I started off in investment banking at JP Morgan after I graduated from college, also went to Texas A&M, did not know Elizabeth then, although we have a ton of mutual friends. And, you know, I saw the corporate world, but I was most excited about the entrepreneurs I got to work with, the people that had built these massive businesses that had really scaled, and it brought me back to those roots of entrepreneurship. So I started 2 companies prior to Hello Alice, one that failed in the retail space. I have utmost respect for anybody who has to manage inventory and logistics and heavily kind of operational business. It's probably why I gravitated towards tech after. I closed that company down after 2 years. And it was a really tough experience. It was kind of the first thing in life that I'd poured everything into that didn't work. And I had to prove to myself at that point that I could run a business and I could run a business successfully. And I started a second company in the digital media space that I ultimately ended up selling after 7 years. And it proved to me that the same entrepreneur can have really different experiences based on knowledge and access to resources. And after I sold that company, all these doors started opening up to me. People were inviting me to come speak at conferences and join these networks and all these things that I needed at day one that I had no idea existed out there. And here I was, I just, you know, had my first child. I just sold my business, so I wasn't even working in that window in between. And I started deploying all these resources to people that I knew that were in the early stages that needed to know about these opportunities. And I would say, look, don't bring me up on the stage, but bring this other entrepreneur. Don't invite me to this network, but invite this other person in. And that was really the roots of Hello Alice, was just seeing this massive opportunity of how inefficiently word of mouth worked in this environment, that what if we could use technology to connect people efficiently and at scale? How would that make a difference? Because I saw it happening at a micro level over and over and over again, just based on a phone call or based on an email. And then I met Elizabeth, and I think as she was coming from this really macro level through the UN and through her work with the Global Entrepreneur Council and her work at Dell, seeing this macro perspective, and I came with a very micro perspective. Here's my experience as a business owner. Here's what I know about technology and how we can solve this problem. Here's how I've seen it impact, you know, one or two or 10 or 60 or 100 entrepreneurs. What could we do together if we made this impact millions of entrepreneurs?
That's really cool. So you guys have a lot of common background, but didn't know each other at College Station. How did you guys come together and start talking about what eventually became Hello Alice?
By the way, I'd bury the lead, but I also was in the Peace Corps in Bolivia, which is wild. So
we both have really fond memories of Bolivia in a totally different way.
That's amazing.
Yeah, lived in Bolivia and then Texas A&M, and then none of that was connected. So we actually met through a mutual friend, and it was right when I was thinking really hard about how do we help more people in an efficient way scale businesses in the United States, particularly women. And Carolyn was also in that same thought. She had just built the first, I think, very scalable digital accelerator to give back. So she was helping 300 women at a time in this, I thought, very scalable way just by herself. So when I was at Dell working for Michael, we sponsored that accelerator. So got to know Carolyn more. And then we just started chatting. The way the real story goes, we were at this summit series event on the side of a mountain camping with a bunch of entrepreneurs. And I was about 4 beers in. Carolyn was very pregnant. And we were just kind of talking through, why does only this amount of venture capital go to women, this amount go to loans? And I just thought it was awful. And Carolyn kept seeing it as an opportunity. And I think that is a real switch for any entrepreneur that sees a macro problem and flips it over to a opportunity, however you want to talk about it. So I was super attracted to her way of thinking. She's also very technical. I'm not. And I said, can I give you a buzz in a couple of weeks? And I think she thought I was nuts or drank too much or something. And so I did. I called her a few weeks later. We met up in New York and she mapped out what was in her head, what is now the, I would call it the first iteration of what is now Hello Alice. I just thought it was the best thing. We had been looking at Dell for highly scalable solutions to support or invest in after we did the EMC VMware acquisition. And I just thought Carolyn had the best idea. So we were one of those classic groups, never do this, that on a napkin, we wrote out an agreement in a coffee shop in New York of, you know, something we could do together. And then it grew from there.
That's fantastic.
And you'll laugh. Our mutual friend that introduced us, we both separately made a phone call to her. We're like, we don't really know each other that well. We're thinking about working together. What do you think? And she's like, you two are so different.
Don't do it.
I just don't think it's going to work.
It won't
and
work.
We both ignored her and we worked together anyway. And now we always laugh that it was like the best decision we could have made.
That's great. It's actually fascinating hearing the story of co-founders coming together, how some of them have been friends since they were 12 years old and have, you know, created a lemonade stand together and then built and then later did a thing. And then how so many come sort of out of the blue with a random connection and kind of meet that way is definitely no commonality that I've found. It's fascinating to hear the stories.
Well, we did fast forward, Bill, in a huge way. And we don't talk about this a lot, but we got the opportunity by Michael Dell actually to go help build out the initial engineering of Hello Alice at Pivotal Labs, Rob Mee's shop out of San Francisco. Neither of us lived there. Carolyn was in Houston at the time. I was up in Sonoma County. We both had two infants each, and I still had a day job, and Carolyn had quit to build this, took a huge risk. And so we ended up moving in together. It was kind of a crazy thing. And we shared, as women entrepreneurs do, we hired probably three babysitters, and we just made it work. We each had, you know, I think we had a one-year-old and a four-year-old each, and we took the Golden Gate Transit bus from Sonoma down to San Francisco every day at 5 a.m., $7 bus, and we did that until the thing was built, and it was a wild, wild time, wild time.
How long was that period?
It was about a 9-month span. And then we actually ended up almost every summer moving near each other and sharing childcare, literally up through COVID until this last year. So that's almost 8 years in a row. We just found, both as working mothers and wanting to be great CEOs, childcare community people is just the way it would work. So we still like each other. We're still together.
Needless to say, our husbands and kids are very, very close. So that helps a lot too. When we're like, we're all coming together every summer all the time.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, is if your kids are all still best friends. Sounds like they are.
Oh, they love each other.
They are.
Love each other.
Dynamite.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know, Carolyn, you're spending some time in Spain. So maybe that'll have to be an upcoming summer's move-in over in Spain. That'd be a lot of fun.
I know. I'm working the lure for everybody for sure.
Nice. Well, let me try and bridge a little bit from this idea. I mean, for you came at it from different angles, but all had this point of view that, look, small businesses were really important. They were very underserved. People didn't really know how to access resources, and there just weren't enough resources out there. How did you go from that kernel of an idea to what you described, Carolyn, that Hello Alice is now? I mean, was it a pretty linear thing of, hey, here's an idea and we're going to execute this idea, whatever? Or did you start out with 20 different versions of it and, you know, now you're on one you'd never thought of? I mean, I'd love to hear kind of that journey.
You know, it's funny. I would say it's so different and so much the same. Every once in a while, I'll be cleaning out files and I pull out our original pitch deck and I look at it and I'm like, the essence of our business has not changed a bit. Our mission hasn't changed. The idea that we could more efficiently connect entrepreneurs to resources hasn't changed. I think what changed was recognizing the massive opportunity on so many different levels of how it impacted enterprise companies, what the bank problems were, and how this could actually support the work that they were doing, how it supported government efforts, and, you know, so many different constituents in the market. I think that was the piece that we had some knowledge of. We always knew we would build a model that did not charge the entrepreneurs because we knew they were broke and we couldn't build a business model that charged them for access to services. And we also knew if entrepreneurs made money, everybody selling into those entrepreneurs was going to make money. We knew governments were going to make more money. So we knew everybody was going to benefit financially. And we said there has to be a piece of the pie in there somewhere for us. But we had no idea what the real service offering would be to those constituents. And I'm going to give Elizabeth major props here because she is just incredible about bringing the right people to the table as we tackle these problems. I kind of lay everything out and I'm like, here's what we have at our disposal. Here's some ways that we might be able to tackle this. Let's figure this thing out. And just bringing all of those people to the table where we can really, and people that were really invested in these problems that could sit and talk and work through things with us, and who bet on us in the early days when we didn't really know what our product was necessarily. We just knew we could connect them more efficiently to a lot of small business owners for whatever their need was. And it was a ton of trial and error, a lot of what worked well. You know, I think we always got the pushback from our team, particularly in the early days, that we're just doing all this bespoke stuff. But the reality is it was experimenting. We were experimenting with the market and trying to figure out what really scales here and where is there consistent and massive opportunity, and we just didn't know. It was hard in the early days, I think, and very time-consuming in a lot of ways, but I don't think we would be where we are today without all of that experimentation.
That makes a lot of sense. If you look back over that period, I mean, I'm sure there's, you know, 20,000 decisions you've made along the way. Are there any that kind of stand out, I guess, in a couple directions? One that seemed really complex at the time, you made a decision and you look back and like, wow, that was awesome. And we got that one right and led us down the right path. And then was there conversely a complex decision that, you know, in hindsight, hey, maybe that was the wrong call. We needed to learn from it, go back, fix things later. I mean, I'd just love to hear if any in particular has stood out.
One is not charging entrepreneurs, which I already mentioned, but we have seen a lot of competitors enter this space who charge. And we got pushed from every investor, I think, that we pitched to in the early days, really pushed us. You know, you could do a subscription model, or you could build this way, or have you thought about always charging the entrepreneur? And we held really hard and fast on that. It said, absolutely not. Like, we don't think it's going to work. And here are the reasons we don't think it's going to work. Some investors agreed and invested, some did not and walked away. But the reality is our competitors who build, the business owners, the majority of them, if not all of them, are not here today. And we're still standing. And so I think that says a lot about going with your gut in terms of what the market will and won't sustain.
Yeah, Carolyn's right. Conviction in your model, learning and listening to all the yeses and nos, but that conviction, I would say, particularly for your listeners, anytime we've said no and focused more has been a huge benefit. I know that's a big, broad ranging, but in the early days, we boiled the ocean. We wanted to help small business owners with anything they need, their first hire, their first website. And we just continue to focus in on access to capital, equitable access to capital. And the more we focused, just the better we got. I would say the biggest risk we've ever taken was during COVID-19. We, as you can imagine, our customer set, small business owners, you know, since the Great Depression, have never ever had anything like that. We actually took a huge chunk of money and delayed the build of our credit program. And we decided to build what was called the COVID-19 Business Center. Carolyn's team took basically what would probably take 2 quarters to build and built it in a week, which was a navigation tool for a small business owner based on their industry and their size to get through COVID. How do you apply for PPP, EIDL? When are you closed? When are you open? We had a mental health center. That ended up being our greatest growth period and really kicking off the rocket ship growth we have today. We had at one point 200,000 small business owners a day accessing that digital center. And it was a real risk. You know, we had raised money. We just closed our round to build this credit program, which now I'm happy to say is launched and doing quite well. But delaying that, going back to investors, our board, saying, we're listening to our small business owners. We think they need us right now. We need to be able to pivot, do this for them. It is a great risk and it's a great cost. We were also, like everyone, you know, we did a RIF 20%. That's what everyone was doing at the time. And it really not only paid off as the business, it was absolutely the right thing to do for our customers. And I think that's probably to date the biggest risk we've ever taken, but we really felt like it was the right thing to do, particularly for our mission. So those are just a couple of thoughts.
None of us want to go through COVID again. It was definitely a moment that, you know, allowed so many people to rise to the occasion. And it sounds like what you did was absolutely aligned with the mission, just not in a way that you ever would have expected.
Right.
It's great to hear the nimbleness to help them the way that they needed it.
I do think it's important that any founder admits when they're wrong, but it takes years. You know, Carolyn and I, we've had great investors and we've had tough investors. And when I look back on some of the investors we brought into our cap table, I wish we wouldn't have in the early years. Now, the last two and a half rounds, we've gotten more savvy about diligence and making sure the add value is there. Y'all at QED are a prime example of not just check writing, but adding serious value. But I think when your naivete is there, you're trying to get money in the door, you're trying to run a business, you don't know anyone yet, particularly if you're new to venture, that can be really hard. So I think we had to learn along the way of how to pick the right investors.
Yeah, that's a pretty common one. And, you know, it's kind of funny going through, coming out of COVID, you know, this industry had an 18-month insane boom. And the weirdest thing looking back is how the number one sort of result of that was that the average funding round gets done in like 4 days instead of 4 months. What you talk about, the need to get to know your investors, get the investors to know you, these are going to be long relationships. It's kind of shocking to me that that's kind of the trend of how that happened. It is what it is, and we'll all live through it. But I think the relationship aspect of this is so important in all directions, because as what we're about to talk about, you never know when the unexpected is going to hit, and the ability to work together is so critical.
Absolutely.
Cool. Well, look, let me move to this topic that we teased up front. You all are the subject of a class action lawsuit, which, if I understand it, came completely out of left field and blindsided you and really is kind of getting at the heart of your mission of kind of why you're doing what you're doing. So, you know, let me turn it to you to kind of explain a little bit of what happened directly.
Sure. So I can just be very technical for a minute. Carolyn and I are learning, has never been sued. We're pretty right as rain company, but you got to be very specific. But we were served a class action lawsuit by America First Legal, Stephen Miller, as well as Jonathan Mitchell, and proclaiming reverse discrimination based on our grants programs for Black-owned businesses. We, as Carolyn mentioned, have done almost $40 million in small grants to all ethnicities, genders, veterans, military spouses in all 50 states. We do, however, very much believe in ensuring a very specific focus on underrepresented small business owners who will very much contribute to this economy when given equal access to capital. Sometimes grants are the best way to do that. So we've been sued. It definitely was left field. It's a meritless case, a baseless case. These are grant awards. They are putting this older law that is called 1981 forward on discrimination. However, the private sector has every capability and ability to actually choose and give awards, financial awards. So it's blown us out of the water. I will say, entrepreneurs, we all, you know, live through adversity, whatever that means. However, sometimes at least adversity is coming from a place of logic, maybe on the other side, when this absolutely is not.
That's fascinating. So really getting at the heart of saying, hey, you're coming up with grants that are going to help, in this case, African-American entrepreneurs really get a step forward. I mean, the broader question is multiple underrepresented groups. Maybe go back to that sort of first moment when this started to hit. I mean, what was your reaction and how did this all come to be?
I mean, I think like anything, right? You're busy running a business and there's so many important things that need to be done to make sure that we're getting more money into the hands of business owners. So I think similarly, I kind of couple this with when COVID first hit, there's that, what are we going to do as a business? What does this mean for us as a company that you go through? And then there's very quickly a, what does this mean for all of the entrepreneurs that we serve? And Elizabeth mentioned how we pivoted really quickly over COVID. And for this, the same thing. We took a step back and said, look, what this can do to us, and we can get through this. We know we'll figure this out like we always do. But there are much broader implications for the 1.3 million business owners and beyond that we serve and support. And how does this impact them? And what does this mean for them and the funding that they need? And how do we ensure that we are really sticking to our mission here of making sure we're putting as many dollars into the hands of as many business owners? And so that's really how we've approached this, is it's important to win this mostly because there's a massive impact here. When you look at less than 2% of venture capital goes to women, a tiny portion of that goes to women of color. And when you look at just people of color in general, it's minuscule compared to the amount of funding that's out there. They're starting their businesses with less capital, half the capital of their white counterparts. And so to approach an issue like this is an apples to apples comparison and say, look, we can flip this around and this is what's fair for one versus what's fair for the other. There's just massive, I mean, economic implications here. And that's where we've kind of focused our time and energy and want to spend our time, is how do we ensure that we're taking every resource out there, money from wherever it might come from, into the hands of whoever it might go to. It's a number one pain point for all business owners. And we're not going to stop fighting until we get every business owner with a good idea and the will to work for it, the money that they need.
And Bill, this is setting an incredibly dangerous precedent. When Carolyn talks about the pressure we have, one is, it is critical that the private sector has the ability to move dollars where they think it's appropriate as a business. That's one. Two is, these cases should be litigated in Congress. This is a very dangerous precedent that the private sector is being sued like an ambulance chaser to change the interpretation of law. That is not normal. Most of these cases generally are negotiated and debated in Congress in committee. So a lot of these actors who are going out and suing private companies and almost systematically suing them and then raising money off that suit for the next one is very dangerous to our economy. And it goes very much against our, we're capitalists, Carolyn and I. You know, we are going after, if you tell us there's a $40 billion gap in the BIPOC community in credit and loans, that's a massive opportunity. We want to create more jobs. We want to get money into the hands of those folks. And if we have to say, first, we're starting with grants, then we're going to secured credit, unsecured. As a company that wants to make money and create jobs, we should be able to do that. So it's important that LPs, CEOs really watch this trend of negotiating policy through lawsuits in the private sector versus pushing those back up to Congress.
This should not be a political issue, regardless of which side of the aisle you might sit on. Small business owners are the most trusted voice in America. It is one of the very few bipartisan issues of support when it comes to politics. And so trying to manipulate this into a political issue is incredibly disheartening. So our goal is really, how do we kind of recapture and aggregate the voice of small business and put the power back in their hands? Because again, Republican, Democrat, whatever they may be, the reality is when small business owners succeed, both sides of the aisle recognize this is incredibly beneficial to our country.
No, it makes sense. Now, I know that you've gotten a great outpouring of support. I mean, we talked about the, I guess, what's the opposite of support? The lawsuit on one hand, but I know you've gotten a great outpouring of support. I mean, I guess, I wonder if you could take a minute to describe kind of how that's felt. And then for our listeners, you know, what could folks do to help?
Yeah, I appreciate that. We are doing what we love to do. We decided to put more capital out there. We have launched a new grants program called Elevate the American Dream, where a small business owner can nominate themselves or the general public can nominate their coffee shop, their accountant, their childcare center for an Elevate the American Dream award, a potential grant. Everyone gets mentorship. So we've been thrilled when we came out with our public statement that all 50 states, we've had thousands of people already nominate small business owners. And then we have put up our own capital to produce grants for those small business owners. So anyone could go to elevatetheamericandream.com and nominate their small business. We'll be pushing this through the end of the year. It's our way to say we're taking the high road here. We think what we're doing is critical. And we've been really proud that everyone from Reid Hoffman to Ken Chenault to folks coming out of the woodwork, but most of all, small business owners coming out to support each other, which has been really exciting and special.
It's fantastic to hear. It sounds like you've been through two incredible crises. Maybe it's even more than that. First COVID, now this. I wonder if each of you can pick one or two things that you've really learned about yourself or learned from a leadership perspective, kind of navigating through these twin crises.
Prioritizing the customer is critical. I think with each of these situations, and frankly, just everything in general, there's so many times I think that you can look at things from lots of perspectives, right? What's the fastest solution to roll out, or what's going to make you the most money, or what's going to provide the, you know, the most information or insights? But at the end of the day, really focusing on what is most beneficial to the small business owners that we serve has always been core to the decisions that we make. And that means there have been times when we've walked away from money. It's been times that we have, like Elizabeth said, we've delayed rolling out a particular feature set. There have been times that we've taken something that feels quite risky, but always knowing this is ultimately what is best for the business owner. I mean, always challenging ourselves. I think when we feel like we're starting to kind of veer off a little bit or something's not working, typically it's because we haven't prioritized what that business owner needs. So I think that for me is a lesson that early on, I feel like in our journey, one, I think I would have been a lot more vocal internally about what that means for us as a team. I think many times we kind of hired this amazing talent and brought people into the team or listened to investors and felt like they had the answer. They knew more than us because they had done all these things or had this great pedigree or this wonderful resume. At the end of the day, I think the people that really know are the customers, and we have this very direct line into them. And so we have to be really strong and really purposeful about listening to those needs.
I'll just add that as a leader, if we just look at the decade Carolyn and I have been working together, to your point, Bill, there is some kind of crisis every other year. And that might be global in nature. It might be internal to your business. It might be macroeconomic. Your time is so valuable as a leader because there will be things that only you can solve, period. And so how do you really lean on the expertise of your team and your co-founder to get through those times is essential. I can think of four things over a decade, whether they were personal, economic. SVB was our largest investor before QED. That was a big deal for us when they collapsed this year. But Carolyn and I, the first thing we do is call each other. Which one of us has taken this one? Which one of us is managing the business? Who else are we going to lean on right now? Which board member do we call? You have to, in those moments, to really understand how to manage talent and time and know that no amount of planning in the world is going to prevent you, if you are an entrepreneur, from a crisis at some point in your business, particularly if you stand for something. So having that management is important.
I always channeled the words of my father in these moments, that this too shall pass. We will get through it. And so it's weathering the storm. But Elizabeth's right. I think having a team that you can rely on and divide and conquer on these things, because they are all consuming for a single human, any one of them. They're all consuming many times for multiple humans. But making sure that you're still keeping an eye on building the company and growing the business and being able to push the big strategic things forward in the meantime.
You mentioned that quote, Carolyn. Nigel says that all the time when giving advice to people. So maybe in some past life, Nigel and your dad came across each other. I'm not sure, but that's funny to hear that. I think we've got tons more we could talk about. I know we're a bit short on time, but really have appreciated y'all coming on and sharing such an inspiring story. We always try to end with the same question on the podcast. So I'd like to ask each of you, if you had one tip to share with an aspiring entrepreneur, what piece of advice would you give?
I'll say make the ask. This is actually something that I've really learned, frankly, from Elizabeth, just not being afraid to make the ask. I'm one of these people that likes to have everything perfect and prepared and set and structured. And so many times it's when you have the right people around the table and you bring together the right minds, things happen much more efficiently and much more effectively and often very differently than they would otherwise. And so my advice to many now, and I think a lesson that I've learned over the years of running this company and running other businesses, is the more you put yourself out there and the more you make the ask, the better you're setting yourself up for success.
And I'll just add, plan around your passion. Passion is what will get you through both the highs and the lows, and just always circle back to it because it'll be what pulls you through and inspires others. So plan your passion.
Makes sense. And look, that passion and commitment to the mission is something that's come through this entire conversation. And it's clear that every time something hits you, that's the thing that you chew back to. And that's really impressive to see. So anyways, thank you so much for coming on today. It was great to experiment with a slightly different format. Clearly, the two of you can complete each other's sentences. So it's not even clear that, you know, it really is two people on here, but sure seems like it based on the video tiles.
Well, thanks, Bill. And we would be remiss if we didn't give great love and shout out to our board member, Frank Rotman at QED. So he is our North Star. So
Frank puts up with the two of us just about every day. So
we're very happy to have Mr. FinTech Junkie himself here at QED. So thanks so much for coming in and joining today. And to all of our listeners, take care and thanks for listening. This has been the FinTech Thought Leaders Podcast, your window into the world of venture capital and financial services with today's digital disruptors. QED is proud to provide the best FinTech advice you can get. To learn more or to read the full show notes from today's episode, check out qedinvestors.com and be sure to also follow QED on Twitter and LinkedIn at QED Investors. Thanks for listening.